This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating in New York at WBAI. In today's program, a diplomatic assault outside the United Nations under the noses of Homeland Security, Secret Service, FBI, and the NYPD. Also today, we'll be speaking with Ray McGovern, meeting with President Ahmadinejad earlier this week. All that and more. This is 5 o'clock shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York. This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and New York was the scene of an incident that brought back shades of Benghazi when diplomatic officials failed to be protected in the country within which they were being hosted. Overnight, there was an assault by people purporting to be Iranian exiles and possible members of Mujahideen Ikhalq, who surrounded and chased through crowded traffic the official spokesperson for the president of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is how the incident overnight is reported by Fars, the Iranian news agency. The Iranian delegation in New York came under attack by members of the terrorist Mujahideen Ikhalq organization, known to Iranians as MKO for Mujahideen Ikhalq organization, in the presence of U.S. police. The terrorist members of the MKO, also known as the MEK, attacked Iran's foreign ministry spokesperson, Ramin Mehman Parast, near the United Nations headquarters. He and several other Iranian officials were walking to their hotel when they were surrounded and assaulted by MKO terrorists on Wednesday. New York City police and the U.S. security forces made no arrests as the attackers physically abused members of the Iranian delegation accompanying Iran's President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad in his visit to the United States to address the 67th General Assembly. The United States is responsible for the security of all diplomatic delegations attending the UN meetings as the host to the world body. The incident came days after U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton notified Congress that she plans to take MKO, or MEK, off of a State Department terrorist list. The notification will be followed by formal removal in the coming days from the list of foreign terrorist organizations, which includes more than 50 groups. Earlier this month, the seventh and last group of the MEK terrorists left Camp Ashraf, their main training center in Iraq. The last group of the evacuees included 88 terrorists. They have been transferred to Camp Liberty, which lies northeast of the Baghdad International Airport. Camp Liberty is a transient settlement facility and a last station for the MKO in Iraq. Earlier this year, the Iraqi government set a new deadline for them to evacuate from Camp Ashraf by October of this year. The MEK or MKO cannot find shelter outside of Iraq, as it is blacklisted by much of the international community, including the United States, at least at this point in time. That from the Fars news agency. The Associated Press adds a few more details to the incident, including the attack and the New York City Police Department. Spokesperson Paul Brown saying that, in his opinion, he believed that the threats to the diplomat were merely verbal. However, the New York Daily News quotes a white man from the Midwest wearing a leather jacket who claims to have solidly punched the presidential spokesperson in the stomach during the running melee. During the General Assembly session, there was an anti-Iranian demonstration that featured such speakers as the mayor who harassed the Iranian delegation during his term in office, Rudolph Giuliani. Also present there was House Speaker, or former House Speaker, Newt Gingrich, along with others who have been associated with the campaign to remove the Mujahideen from the terror list. Also speaking at that rally were former U.S. Representative to the United Nations, Carolyn Maloney, and former Representative Patrick Kennedy of Rhode Island. There were audiographic recordings of the incident as it unfolded, and this is what it sounded like when fists fly.
Spit in his face. Look, they're getting him.
That was the contemporaneous audio of the overnight assault against the spokesperson for the president of the Islamic Republic of Iran as he attempted to make his way to his hotel from the headquarters of the United Nations. This under the close scrutiny of not only the Secret Service and the FBI, also Homeland Security and the New York City Police Department. In that audio, we heard the people recording it saying, they hit him, they're hitting him. And the reference to drive away refers to after a long period of time, finally putting the besieged diplomat into a police cruiser, New York City Police Department cruiser number 3919. This is 5 o'clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and we're now joined live by Reza Marashi. He is with the National Iranian American Council and has been keeping track of people who are identified as being involved in this assault and battery on the Iranian diplomat known as the Mujahideen-e-Khalq. Welcome to the Shadow, Reza.
Thank you very much for having me.
Who are these people?
Well, by the State Department's own definition on its website, the Mujahideen-e-Khalq is a Marxist Islamic organization that seeks the overthrow of the Iranian government in Iran, in Tehran, through its military wing and its political front. Very recently, they were removed from the list of foreign terrorist organizations that the United States puts together by agreeing to relocate from their military base in Iraq. And, you know, it's a very controversial decision. Some have accused that decision was politicized But that's where we stand right now. So there's no shortage of irony, and it's rather unfortunate that less than 1 week after being taken off the terrorist list, they violently attack a diplomat in New York City.
Well, we do understand that they are being evacuated from their troubled points at American bases in Iraq, but that under the jurisdiction of what purports to be an independent government in Baghdad. And I do not understand the connection, Reza, between a supposedly sovereign nation of Iraq ejecting known terrorists, and why that has to be rewarded by Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama.
Well, I wouldn't go as far as to say that it's been rewarded by Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. I think that as a result of the Bush administration invading Iraq in 2003, we opened a Pandora's box that included a whole litany of very complicated issues, many of which we've seen on the news, which is why there was essentially a civil war going on as recently as 2 to 3 years ago, if not more recently. But something lesser known, but certainly of serious concern to many inside the United States and abroad, was the MEK, as the Mujahideen Khalq is called for short. The MEK was relocated from Iran shortly after the Iranian Revolution into Iraq. Saddam Hussein financed them, bankrolled them, and armed them up until the overthrow of Saddam Hussein by the United States in 2003. So here you have this designated terrorist organization on America's terrorist list in a country that we've invaded. And at that time, we went to the military base that Saddam Hussein gave them. And, you know, in a very no-brainer type decision, they agreed to lay down their arms when the American military came knocking at their door. As a result of that, however, you know, you still had about approximately 3,000 to 3,500 of these individuals in a military base in Iraq that still did have some weaponry in the camp, and there were divisions inside the Bush administration and subsequently the Obama administration on how to best address this issue. The primary concern of the Obama administration, as a former State Department official, what I can say is that there's reason to believe that over half of these individuals, and as many as 70% of them, were being held in this camp against their will. So in an effort to avoid a Jonestown-type situation of mass suicides or mass violence, the Obama administration wanted to gain unfettered access to the rank-and-file members of this group that were in this military camp in an effort to relocate them and reprocess them as refugees. In order to do that, you know, they felt, right or wrong, that they had to remove this this terrorist listing, because you cannot relocate individuals who are members of a designated terrorist organization. Very complicated and very controversial.
Well, yes, that is quite a questionable tale or pretext, because what I see here, Reza, is a continuity of interest for the organization between the days of the Bush administration, and it was Hillary Clinton herself, the current Secretary of State of the United States, who just a matter of days ago officially informed Congress of her intention, which, as I understand it, she has not yet fully declared, but she duly notified Congress of her intention to de-terrify list MEK. And yet this behavior, regardless of any supposed Jonestown scenario, is perhaps diplomatic Jonestown, because it was the Republicans, many of them, who were the beneficiaries of fees and speaking engagements to promote and lobby for the delisting of this organization. And among them, Tom Ridge, the former director of so-called Homeland Security. We're talking about John Bolton, the Bush epoch ambassador to the United Nations. And of course, one of the ringleaders of the rally that incited to this moment overnight, former New York City Mayor Rudolph Giuliani. So I'm a bit perplexed, because what the Obama administration is doing is what the Bush administration was unable to do.
Well, you made a lot of good points, so let's unpack it a bit, and I would make two points to tack on to the end of yours. One, I would say that it was actually a bipartisan effort of former U.S. government officials that were on the MEK's payroll. It was Democrats as well as Republicans, so you had people like Ed Rendell, you had people like Jim Jones, Obama's former national security advisor, really high-level officials that were getting this money and speaking out on behalf of the MEK, so that's one. But then two, as a result of what this decision that was made, I would say that it wasn't just Hillary Clinton. These decisions typically aren't made within the U.S. government in a vacuum, and they're typically not made by one individual. There's a lot of differing opinions that go into it, and usually it's a process of achieving some kind of consensus. So while Hillary Clinton is the person that's notifying Congress, and you're correct in noting that she hasn't done so yet, there is also widespread discussion that goes on in the White House and the State Department and in other U.S. government agencies in order to reach this kind of decision. And, the State Department has said that they, sometime in the coming days they will say more and about the decision that they've made. And I actually look forward to it because by their very own definition of how to get off the terrorist list, the U.S. government's own definition, giving up your military base and relocating to another one is not enough in order to meet the qualifications and the criteria.
We saw the unbridled passions of fanatics at work on the streets of New York City, reminding us of what happened in Benghazi last night. And if the organization is to be liberated from the current constraints, what more might we expect here? Can you give us some kind of indication of the behavior of MEK in other places and other times? What kind of behavior had caused them since, I believe, 1997 to be characterized as terrorists? What did they used to do and what might they be able to do?
That's a great question. A brief history of what they've done first, and then I'll talk about what the fear is going forward if this delisting decision holds up. During the 1970s, they staged terrorist attacks in Iran, killed several U.S. military personnel and civilians working on defense projects in Iran at the time, set off bombs in Iran at the U.S. Information Service office, which was part of the embassy at the Iranian American Society, and several U.S. companies to protest the visit of high-level American officials. So a lot of violence and killings on the part of the MEK in the 70s. In the 1980s, they carried out terrorist attacks both inside of Iran and inside of Europe. And then when you move into the 1990s, you saw them fight on behalf of Saddam Hussein against the Kurds in Iraq after the very first Gulf War, and Iraqi Shia as well. And then in the 2000s or early 2000s, you would start to see a renewed attempt to conduct terrorist attacks inside of Iran, some of which were successful. And in 2003, French authorities arrested approximately 160 MEK members at operational bases that they believed the MEK was using to coordinate finance and planning for terrorist attacks. And then upon the arrest of their leader, MEK members took to the streets in Paris and lit themselves on fire. So this is an idea of what they've done in the past over the last couple of decades. The primary concern going forward, and there are many, but the primary concern going forward is that once you get off this list, then Congress can allocate money to you, much like they did to the Iraqi National Congress shortly before the invasion of Iraq, to create a regime change type organization, create regime change type propaganda moving forward. So American taxpayers should be concerned that if the United States government isn't careful, particularly if a Congress that it already has very low approval ratings isn't careful, we could start to see taxpayer dollars going to fund an organization that very recently was on America's list of terrorist organizations in an effort to overthrow a government that our president of the United States still says that there's time to pursue a peaceful diplomatic process to resolve conflict with.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. We are speaking live with Reza Marashi. He is with the National Iranian American Council, and we appreciate your insight today. And the other big question is this organization yet another example of the United States government supporting terrorism in the interest of geostrategic objectives? In other words, is this like the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, and did not the United States take part in supplying, training, arming, and or funding them?
Well, we've come to learn that the United States did in fact support the Afghan Mujahideen in the 1980s in their war with the Russians. That we know. I think it's too early to tell whether or not the United States government plans on doing with the MEK going forward. We've seen reports, for example, Cy Hirsch in The New Yorker saying that the United States during the Bush administration had supplied financing, training, weaponry, things of that sort, to the MEK in an effort to conduct terrorist attacks inside of Iran. But again, these are unnamed American officials speaking to Cy Hirsch, so I can't independently confirm it.
Though, doesn't it stand to reason that one of the potential purposes of unleashing them is for the continued pressure, clandestine and covert operations against Iran?
Well, that's certainly one possibility, absolutely, because usually where there's smoke, there's fire. But I cannot tell you unequivocally that that is the case, because I haven't seen the hard evidence to support it. So as an analyst, it's my responsibility to say what we know and what we don't know. We have reason to believe, but it hasn't 100% been confirmed.
Well, I thank you for your research and information today. And for people who would care to know more about that, tell us about what you do at the Council and how they can learn more.
No, absolutely. It's my pleasure to chat, and I'd be happy to. The National Iranian American Council is an organization in Washington, D.C. that is nonpartisan, nonprofit, dedicated to advancing the interests of the Iranian American community. We accomplish our mission by supplying resources, knowledge, and tools to enable greater civic participation by Iranian Americans and informed decision-making by lawmakers. If you'd like to learn more, you can visit our website at www.niacouncil.org.
Well, thank you, Reza Marashi. We appreciate your contribution to the process that is unfolding before us, before our very eyes today. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And for some people, the assault on the Iranian diplomat was reminiscent of yet another event in which political, religious, and physical passions got out of control. For some, it was a behavioral reminder of the sodomizing, shooting, beating, and murder of Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi.
Of Libya announced the death of Muammar Gaddafi. This marks the end of a long and painful chapter for the people of Libya, who now have the opportunity to determine their own destiny in a new and democratic Libya.
If he takes the country to war in Iraq without a vote of Congress, which will not exist, then he should be impeached.
Clinton says she would like to see Colonel Gaddafi captured or killed. We examined why she decided to take such an uncompromising position.
So, I mean, that is the land of unconfirmed.
Yes, we came, we saw, he died.
Did it have anything to do with your visit?
No, I'm sure it did.
We have heard that 500,000 children have died. I mean, that's more children than died in Hiroshima. And is the price worth it?
I think this is a very hard choice, but we think the price is worth it.
It's not about justice. It's not about agenda. It's not about mobilizing people. It's about dialing for corporate dollars. These two parties have sold the U.S. government and the American people to the highest bidders.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And continuing on the subject of the clandestine as well as now the diplomatic assaults on Iran, we are joined live by Ray McGovern, former presidential briefer and former analyst with the Central Intelligence Agency. And we want to get into what is being unleashed in this world today, Ray. It's great to have you back. But first, I understand And you were at a very important meeting this week.
Yes, I was. Together with a couple dozen other activists, so-called, we had dinner with the Iranian mission to the United Nations, and then we were able to listen to a panel discussion with President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, the Iranian president, in attendance. He came at 8 o'clock and didn't leave until well after 10, and at the end he gave about a half an hour worth of his own remarks. Various people had a chance to speak, including our president, the president of Veterans for Peace, and it was quite a remarkable meeting, since there he was, and there we were, we don't have that kind of opportunity with our own president. And his remarks were quite interesting. He took a line that was consonant with the presence of the faith leaders from various traditions, from the Jewish, Christian, and Muslim traditions. And it was all a very unusual evening, no acrimony, a lot of questions, and a lot of introspection from Ahmadinejad, who just completed his 8th such visit and won't be there again as president because his term expired. So in a word, it was his sort of valedictory, and it was quite different from the tone of Obama or Netanyahu, and much closer to the tone of Egyptian President Morsi in appealing for some kind of reconciliation and understanding, and speaking out, frontally, but not with acrimony.
Are you saying, Ben Ray, that the impression from the meeting was not one of a Jew-hating nuclear bomb-making supporter of a tyrant in Syria?
No, I think you must have been listening to Netanyahu this afternoon, as I did.
Oh, he pulled the colon of Colin Powell. He went there with visual aids. It was so funny.
I was watching it. Yeah, well, now we have the red line. He drew it himself. You saw it. That will be, it's not only Colin Powell, it was kind of Adlai Stevenson, you know, with the pictures of the Cuban Missile Crisis. But it was quite an interesting performance on Netanyahu's part. You know, the message is very clear, going out from Israel and from those statesmen of our country who are supporting Israel. Look, Iran, this is your last chance to stop doing what we know you're not doing, that is, working on nuclear weapons. It's bizarre. You know, when we write the history of these days, we have the intelligence community, which I labored for 30 years, saying with great distinction and with great exactness, starting in November of 2007, Iran is not working on a nuclear weapon. Okay? When did they stop? Well, they stopped at the end of 2003. Well, how do we know they haven't restarted? Well, there are certain things that we know to expect when they restart working on a weapon. Now, we're not talking about nuclear power. We're not talking about enrichment, which they are entitled to do under the Non-Proliferation Treaty. We're talking about working on a weapon. They are not working on a weapon. Our defense secretary said that in January. Their defense minister said that in January. And yet, you wouldn't know that from the New York Times or the other media, who say Netanyahu is afraid that they're very close to a nuclear weapon. And since the United States wouldn't draw a red line, he literally did so. I didn't realize he was lefty, but it was a pretty good line, pretty straight line, and it means nothing.
Ray McGovern, the session at the United Nations was highlighted by the attack on the spokesperson for President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad of Iran, and it was a bizarre and painful episode to watch, as there was both apparently assault and battery against the spokesperson Ramin Mehman Parast. And if the Obama administration is potentially unleashing the Mujahideen-e-Khalq and giving license for fundraising and other activities through the intended announcement from Secretary of State Clinton to remove them from the terrorist list, Are we perhaps seeing a pattern of blowback miscalculations with President Obama throwing his fate to the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group and all of the diaspora of the al-Qaedas who went to fight in Iraq and elsewhere in Afghanistan? And now we see what Obama did in Libya being replicated, perhaps, with yet another fanatical group involved in terrorism as an ally of United States foreign policy. Are we in the middle of a rerun?
Well, it looks very much like the situation before we invaded Iraq. And I shouldn't be chuckling because this is dead serious. The MEK, who are they? Mujahideen Khalq. They are a group that killed a number of Americans, actually under the Shah. They go back a long way, and they were duly designated as a terrorist organization. They fought for Saddam Hussein against the Iranians. And after the war, after we attacked Iraq, they fled to Iraq and were given sanctuary there. They're designated a terrorist organization, except, whoops, they decided, oh, maybe not. Maybe we will retroactively call them non-terrorist and will magically erase their history. Now, why did they do that? Well, they did that because they need the kind of equivalent that we had with respect to Iraq a decade ago in this fellow named Ahmed Chalabi. Remember Chalabi?
Yes, indeed.
He was the head of the Iraqi National Council. Okay. Now, he claimed to have a following in Iraq. But when I looked into the figures, guess when he left Iraq and hadn't been back? He left the same year that the Brooklyn Dodgers left Brooklyn. 1958. Okay. And he claimed to have some sort of following in Iraq. Now, he was just being used, and he was using us to pretend that, and he hoped to gain power. He was going to recognize Israel. He was going to all do these wonderful things. Now, the Mujahideen Khalq is the same kind of animal. They have no following at all in Iran, but they speak Persian. You know, they're really good, Farsi, and they're really good to infiltrate Iran and assassinate Iranian scientists, as we know this is the practice, or run cyber warfare exercises against Iran. So, you know, it's the old story, Robert. I remember being at Fordham University, my alma mater, and asking the head of the National Clandestine Service, which is the operational arm of the CIA, who was there to do a lecture. I said, how are we going to square the killing of all these folks with what we Catholics pretend is the sanctity of life? One of the questioners asked him, Dr. Sulik, is his name. Dr. Sulik, how do you define a terrorist? Now, what happened was amazing. He looked like the proverbial deer in the headlights. He was, you know, a crowd of about 500 people. And he looked, and he saw me there, and he said, oh, well, Ray McGovern, he was part of the analysis shop. Maybe, Ray, could you answer how we define a terrorist? Now, this is the guy who's running the counterterrorism operations, who's running the drones, who's sending in the midnight squads there to bring that. He couldn't define what a terrorist is. So I got up there, and I said, thank you. I got up to the microphone. I said, well, they're good terrorists and they're bad terrorists. Depends on your point of view. Now, the bad terrorists, those are the ones that don't like you invading your country and can't understand that you're trying to bring democracy. And so they take pot shots at your people. Now, the good terrorists, the ones, you know, that we finance and we run down in Central America to overthrow people like the Nicaraguans put our own anti-terrorists in. Now, everybody in the audience kind of looked at me, and then I said to the speaker, I said, Mike Sulik is his name. I said, Mike, you know, how do you square what you're doing, the people that you're running, with what we Catholics profess to be the sanctity of life? Is it just that we care about the first 9 months of life, and then your kid gets 18, he's cannon fodder, or, you know, you can destroy other folks. And the head of the student council, who is moderating this, no, Dr. Sully, you don't have to answer that. You don't have to answer that. So it became a little bit of a Donnybrook. But the whole idea here is that if there are terrorists, they're good by definition. If there's somebody else's terrorist, they're bad. The Mujahideen Khalq were always regarded as dyed-in-the-wool terrorists. Somehow, somebody gave them a whole lot of money. And we had people like Mukasey, the former attorney general, Ridge, the former head of Homeland Security, and a whole coterie of other dignitaries, I use the word advisedly, giving 10-minute speeches for $25,000 a throw to say, no, Mech, you should take Mech off the terrorist list. And that's what happened. So, you know, when Hillary Clinton gets up now and she says, you know, I think that violence is never justified. Well, the first thing I think, of course, is what her goons did to me there at the GW University when all I did was stand up silently in protest of her speech. So violence is never justified, except for the goons that did that to me, and except for the Mech whose history has magically been erased now. There are terrorists, and we find them very useful sending back into Iran, causing all manner of trouble. It's that bad, and you know, we should be ashamed.
Our guest is Ray McGovern, former officer of the Central Intelligence Agency in the Analysis Division, and former presidential briefer, and an alumnus of Fordham University. I myself, it's appropriate that with questions such as you just recounted, that Jesuit education is useful. I myself was a Jasper at your counterpoint.
So you're one of Giuliani's folks.
Well, we don't like to talk about that. But Giuliani is one of the Mujahideen Khalq folks. Because,
he
was ringleading the rally.
Yeah.
And on the subject of presidential consciousness, we had hoped to speak about this earlier than today. There was an alarming report that claimed that now Barack Obama is actually getting or listening to or pretending to apprehend the daily presidential briefings. This after a wave of criticism for the massive security failure in Benghazi, the lack of marine protection, the several weeks of lies from the administration about the basis or nature of the attack, so highly military coordinated and geographically specific on the compound and the safe house in Benghazi, and the subsequent discovery of documents indicating ongoing CIA operations inside what is laughingly called a nation of Libya, which is really basically a confederation of militias, and not even a confederation since some of them are still fighting with each other. So I could not wait to ask you what your reaction was when you heard that Obama now claims to be getting his intel briefings daily.
Yeah, I guess the initial report was that he was too busy campaigning to listen to the intelligence early in the morning, or at least read it. Well, I think the optics are what's important here. We're in a campaign, a political campaign, the final stages, so he had to disavow any primary interest in campaigning and say, no, I'm taking the daily brief very seriously and so forth. But you know what? The fly in the ointment here is the people that he took on into the White House when he became president. I'm thinking of John Brennan. You know, John Brennan is the counterterrorism advisor. Now, he was supposed to be orchestrating the counterterrorism strategy when that fellow Abdul Muttalib came in from Nigeria with the underwear little bomb there. And how was he thwarted? Simply by the people who sat next to him in the airplane, who squashed the, you know, put out the little fuse that he had lit. How did the fellow in Times Square get prevented from doing what he was doing, or get caught? Oh, by somebody selling T-shirts, right? So, you know, when it comes down to what we're getting for the threefold increase in our intelligence budget since 9/11, Well, there aren't too many victories to be had. Now, when we're talking about John Brennan, and we're talking about Libya and all this kind of thing. See, Brennan is the go-to guy. He was a operative in the CIA, and he became somehow one of Barack Obama's key advisors on intelligence and national security during the first campaign. Well, Obama wanted to make him a head of the CIA, but, you know, it's kind of hard. You know why? Because he spoke openly in favor of what they call extraordinary rendition, which really means kidnapping people off the streets of Milan, sending them to Egypt to get tortured and to say the things we want to say to put in the president's mouth. For example, proving that Saddam Hussein was training members of Al-Qaeda. There's a classic case. That's what we wanted this fellow to say, this fellow named Al-Libi. The Egyptians got him to say that magically. And a month later, he disavowed. He said, look, I just said that to get them to stop torturing me. So now Brennan supervised all that, and the Senate Intelligence Committee knew that. And so when Barack Obama's folks went to the Senate and said, you know, we're going to have John Brennan as head of the CIA, they said, well, you know, we have to book on this guy. You know, talk about kidnapping and torture and black sites and, you know, all, and illegal eavesdropping, you know. I don't think, you know, enough people know about that. We're not going to get him through confirmation if you nominate him. So Obama says, all right, we'll take him in the White House, from where he is now running the operational part of the CIA. So when you look at the miscues in Libya, when you look at the lack of adult supervision, let me put it that way, in places like Syria, well, the CIA is able to do whatever John Brennan thinks might be a good idea at the time. And the key point, Robert, is simply that there is no adult supervision. Mm. There is no oversight. The oversight committees have become the overlooked committees. And that's been the case now for over a decade, since 9/11. So there's no check on this. And all the Congress writes the checks, the cash checks, the money that's needed. But Mujahideen Ikalk is probably a brainstorm of Brennan and the other people, who don't know how much these people are hated in Iran now, just as Chalabi was hated in Iraq.
Ray McGovern, with the bipartisan continuity, but perhaps most clumsily recently executed with the events, the overthrow, and the, as you say, the lack of adult supervision that resulted in the death of a United States ambassador and at least three others that we know of, and the ambassador having journalized, put into his diary that he thought that he was reportedly on a death list from Al-Qaeda, which at first the Obama administration strenuously attempted to deny. Now, with the alliance with these people, the MEKs, M-E-K-S, with the LIFGs, with the utility of Al-Qaeda in an effort to overthrow Syria, have we entered an age of diplomatic herpes in which there is a recurrent inflammation of these covert operations that will come back time and again to irritate us?
Gosh, Robert, I hadn't heard that analogy brought forth before, but I'm afraid you're right on target.
I just made it up.
There's lots of money out there. There's lots of mischief to be done. There are a lot of folks that are signed up to be CIA operatives from the Army, from everywhere else, this is what we do. We do these things. Now, one of the most interesting things I heard, and I was driving back from New York from Ahmadinejad's little party there on Tuesday night, and who is it but the previous U.S. ambassador to Pakistan on the radio? He was speaking at the Carnegie a couple of days before. And he was, in effect, he was saying, you know, it was really a tough year, that 2011, that the CIA guy, Raymond Davis, I spent 4 months trying to get that guy out of jail. And, you know, he was rounded up with illegal weapons and explosives in his car, and he shot those two Pakistanis dead. Oh, it was awful. And then, you know, he went down the whole litany of things where he was actually saying, the CIA is running the thing here. Mm. And what I had to do was sort of pick up the pieces. And you know what he never mentioned? He never mentioned the drone strikes. Now, that is so telling. Here's the previous U.S. ambassador to Pakistan talking about all the troubles, why they don't like us in Pakistan, and he never once mentioned the drone strikes. So he's operating with his own little myopic, bureaucratic lens here, where he takes orders from Washington. Hillary Clinton takes orders from John Brennan, and then they come down to the functionary here, who happens to be the U.S. ambassador to Pakistan. His hands are tied. He can't develop a sensible policy toward the Pakistanis. And he also didn't mention, except in passing, India. Now, that is really bizarre, because the whole deal with respect to Pakistani support for the insurgents, the Haqqani network and so forth in Afghanistan, is because we do not share the same objectives. We would like there to be no terrorists in Afghanistan. Pakistan has been determined to keep their own good terrorists for the Pakistanis. The good terrorists now for Pakistanis, they're bad terrorists for us, but they are being fed, they are being led, they are being armed and supplied by the Pakistani intelligence service. And so here Hillary Clinton and the ambassador say, you know, please, please, Pakistan, what you need to do is turn all your assets to the fight against terror. Don't worry about the Indians. No, don't worry. No, we were just in New Delhi. Really nice folks. We had some really nice tea with them. They said that they're very, very, don't worry about the Indians. Just worry about the terrorists. No. So, and some of the National Security Council folks have said, we have to get the Pakistanis to change their strategic outlook. Well, you're not going to do that, okay? If you know any history at all, you know that everything the Pakistanis do, especially their Army, Navy, and Air Force, is aimed to prevent India from getting more influence. And where are they getting more influence? In Afghanistan. India used to be the primary influential party there. They're going to be that again as soon as the U.S. leaves. And the Pakistanis want to have the capability of causing as much trouble in Afghanistan so India doesn't accede to its former influential state. Now, the fact that our ambassador couldn't elucidate that, and he's a very articulate guy, that he couldn't say that to the folks at Carnegie, and the fact that he never mentioned the drone strikes, which are, as we know from that new study from an NYU law school and Stanford law school, that 400 to 800 civilians have been killed by the drones. You know, that's what's poisoning our relationship with the Pakistani people. And to their great credit, the Code Pink, my friends there, and some other folks are over there in Pakistan now. They're going to make a trek up from Islamabad up into the northwest frontier area to where the drones hit, just to make a point that, you know, that these people are due a life not overshadowed by the constant threat of being droned to death.
We're speaking with Ray McGovern. He is a former officer of the Central Intelligence Agency and presidential daily intelligence briefer over, I believe, four different presidencies. And in the minute that we have remaining, we'd like to thank you, Ray, for this shadow briefing and ask you how people can keep up with your work.
Well, I have a website that my son maintains for me. It's raymcgovern.com. Very easy. I also publish first on consortiumnews.com, which has a much wider circulation than my website, of course. And I'd like to leave you with the thought that my former analyst friends at the CIA are actually doing their job in an honest way. And unless there's great, great pressure on them from their leaders to change their tune, remember, Iran is not working on a nuclear weapon. And if Netanyahu wants to draw all these red lines before the election and is tempted to start a dust-up in the Persian Gulf, you'll know what the game is about. It's not about an imminent nuclear weapon in Iran's hands.
Ray McGovern, thank you so much for the intelligence
welcome.
Today. And this is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. We originate at WBAI. And we thank Chiaco Brozzo for producing today and Michael G. Haskins for engineering. And we welcome your comments, leaks, tips, queries, or suggestions with an email to theshadow@wbai.org. That's theshadow@wbai.org. And for 5 o'clock shadow, I'm Robert Knight in New York.